They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello again, this is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm pleased to welcome today two special guests to our program. The first is Robert Gassaway, a lecturer in law at the University of Chicago Law School. He previously spent 25 years at Kirkland & Ellis. He has represented and advised corporate clients in a wide variety of matters before federal courts, state courts, federal administrative agencies, and federal and state legislative bodies. Robert's specialty has been in complex appellate litigation. His JD is from the University of Chicago, and his BA was from Northwestern University. He also happens to be good friends with our other guest today, James L. Buckley. Based on his storied career in all three branches of government, I'm not sure if I should say Senator, Undersecretary, or Judge Buckley, but regardless, we're happy to have you with us. Our audience is likely well familiar with Mr. Buckley's fascinating and impressive curriculum vitae, but I will try and tick off just a few highlights now as a reminder. Mr. Buckley is a graduate of Yale University. He served in the United States Navy and was discharged with the rank of lieutenant in 1946. He received his law degree from Yale Law School. In 1970, he was elected to the United States Senate and represented the state of New York for one term. Thereafter, he served as an Undersecretary of State for International Security Affairs in the Reagan administration, and next as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He is a great writer and the author of four books, including his two most recent, Freedom at Risk, Reflections on Politics, Liberty, and the State from 2010, and also Saving Congress from Itself, which was published in 2014. Mr. Gassaway, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm very fine and very appreciative for the opportunity to talk with you and with Jim Buckley.
And Mr. Buckley, how are you today?
I'm fine so long as I don't look at the news.
Rob, as I turn over the conversation to you both, I thought you might start us off by explaining, if you'd like, how the two of you first came to know each other.
Well, first of all, thank you, Nate, very much for having us on. I've known Jim constantly for 25 years. He brought me out of the Midwest to clerk on the D.C. Circuit, and he and I have been friends ever since, throughout those 25 years at Kirkland & Ellis. I'm delighted to have a conversation with him today, really as a friend, and trying to share with a wider public some of the many insightful remarks and comments that I've been privy to in conversations with Jim over the last couple of decades. Given the focus of the Federalist Society on Article I reform and Congress and so forth, the meaning of the oath of office, I thought what I'd start with is a famous speech by a famous political thinker, Edmund Burke. It's the speech of to the electors of Bristol, his constituency at the time. And the pull quote from the speech goes like this. Burke says, "Your representative owes you his constituency, not his industry only, but his judgment. And he betrays instead of serving you if he sacrifices his judgment to your opinion." And elsewhere in the same paragraph, he talks about mature judgment and enlightened conscience. Jim, what do you think about that view of a representative's duty based on your tenure in the Senate?
I think it's the appropriate one to take. Too many people believe that members of Congress should just be voice boxes for the temporary views of their constituents. That isn't the way our system was set up. It was set up as representative government in which voters would select somebody whose judgment and views they had trusted, who believed that they were on the right track. But once that person is in office, he has far more access to the facts than any individual citizen is going to be able to have. And it is therefore his obligation to use that judgment to achieve a result that, in his best judgment, best serves the public at large and the country.
And let me expand on that a little bit. You and I know that you were actually wearing the same blue suit, as you once told me, when you raised your right hand and took the oath of office in each branch of government, as a senator, as an undersecretary of state, and then as a judge. So you're probably the world's expert on the meaning of those oaths and the necessity of interpreting the Constitution as an official in each branch of government. I'm going to read you excerpts from congressional debates that came about 2 decades after the founding of the country. It was actually in 1811. And I've got one from a representative, Peter Porter of New York, that I had not heard of, and then one from Henry Clay of Kentucky, obviously one of the big three senators of the 19th century. And what Representative Porter said to his colleagues was the following. Every member has a printed constitution on his table before him, a constitution drawn up with the greatest care and deliberation. And Porter then went on and said, the injunctions of this Constitution, as we in our best judgments shall understand them, and not as they shall be interpreted to us by others, we are solemnly bound by our oaths to obey. And then just to continue in the same vein, the famous Senator Clay of Kentucky said that senators basically should make that Constitution, which we have sworn to support, our invariable guide. Tell us your views on those statements.
I think they're both accurate. No question about it. I would say this with respect to the first quote, and that is that in the initial years of this brand new government, it was quite necessary for individual members of Congress to have active discussions on the floor of the Senate as to how a proposal fits within the Constitution's limits. But over the years, of course, judges have had the opportunity to examine particular provisions of the Constitution under all different kinds of circumstances and spin out a body of precedent which subsequent members of Congress came to rely on, but they nevertheless had the personal responsibility to satisfy themselves. If they had any question about the constitutionality of a provision, they had the duty to satisfy themselves whether it was an appropriate exercise of authority or an inappropriate one.
Well, that brings up another issue. Nate mentioned just a moment ago that you recently wrote a book called Saving Congress from Itself, which implies that Congress may be in need of saving from itself. So just tell me at the highest level, what ails the contemporary Senate that you served or the contemporary Congress?
The problem is that over the years, especially beginning with the New Deal and compounded by the Johnson administration, there was such an impulse in Congress to scratch every itch in the body of politics that there was a vast increase of the business. And if you at a certain point, you simply did not have the time to do a proper job with respect to any piece of legislation. Once upon a time, the Senate earned the reputation for being the world's greatest deliberative body. My guess is it's been a half century or more before it truly deliberated about anything that came before it. There's just a limit to what a particular human being can do in studying and absorbing and making judgments.
Well, let me pivot now, if I can, to one of the other jobs that you had, the job of the federal judge. And just an initial question, is the oath that you took as a federal judge materially different from the one that you took when you were United States Senator?
They are identical.
And could you compare and contrast your understanding of the duties of those two jobs and the meanings of those oaths and how they should be carried out?
Well, you would look to the Constitution, what authority the Constitution grants to senators as opposed to what it grants to judges. A member of the Senate has the responsibility of coming up with proposals for developing laws, passing laws that advance that particular senator's understanding of what serves the public interest. In contrast, a judge's responsibility is not to make law, but to apply the law that Congress itself had enacted.
Well, let me talk a little bit about that, because one extremely influential federal judge was Justice William Brennan, and I know that you've commented on his understanding of constitutional law in one of the other books that Nate mentioned, Freedom at Risk. One of the quotes that you comment on is this one from Justice Brennan, which he gave, I believe, at a speech at Georgetown University. Says Justice Brennan, "The genius of the Constitution rests not in any static meaning it might have had in a world that is dead and gone, but in the adaptability of its great principles to cope with current problems and current needs." Tell us what you think of that statement.
There's a difference between applying the Constitution and adapting it and facing a new situation and having the audacity to say that as a judge, you can decide how it should be adapted rather than entrusting that responsibility to the voters.
And then I have another quotation here that you drew my attention to years ago. Again, this is Justice Brennan saying, quote, "The act of interpretation must be undertaken with full consciousness that it is, comma, in a very real sense, comma, the community's interpretation that is sought." What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that begs an important question. What is it that entitles a tenured member of a highly elite, specialized body to decide what adaptations make sense? It illustrates what's gone, the problem that has arisen in American jurisprudence as applied to the Constitution beginning in the 1930s, when a group of justices decided that ours was a living Constitution and therefore had to be adapted, and then presumed that they had the authority to do that as opposed to the people.
And let's talk then about some of the many proposals that you've made over the past few years since you've retired from hearing cases at the D.C. Circuit to address either the problems that you see with the contemporary Senate, the deliberative problem that you talked about, or perhaps the interpretive problems that you just described on the judiciary. One of these that's going to be familiar to every lawyer, and certainly every lawyer in Washington, involves the so-called Chevron Doctrine. Can you describe what the Chevron Doctrine is and what your views are?
The Chevron Doctrine says that if an administrative office applying a particular provision of a statute that happens to be ambiguous, that whatever that administrator decides is a proper application is the proper one to be applied by a court, so long as it is, quote, not irrational. When I was in the Senate, I recall the first time I was working on specific language of a statute, and I said, well, this isn't quite clear. And one of my older colleagues said, Jim, forget about that. The court will tell us what it means, not the EPA, and not the FCC, not any one of these others. What this is an invitation to members of a bureaucracy to push the envelope in the direction they want to go. And too often they end up at a point where a judge applying the Chevron Doctrine as they are required if you are an inferior court in a direction that just goes too far. And it is, I think, resulted in a significant distortion of the authority that should be granted to a bureaucrat.
And while we're on the topic of executive power, you've also suggested constitutionally reforming the executive branch by limiting presidents to a single 6-year term. Can you comment on that proposal?
Yes. That idea popped into my head shortly after I was elected. I was invited by President Nixon to come to the Oval Office to say hello. As I walked in, he was behind the desk on the far end of the room. with George Shultz, that was then the OMB, Office of Management, and so on, and some functionary of the Nixon administration. I heard Nixon say, but Milton Friedman didn't realize that there was an election coming up. That led me to conclude that the three of them had agreed that something that had been under discussion should be pursued politically, despite the fact that they agreed with Milton Friedman. The pressure of an election coming up, I mean, this is an election, it wouldn't come up for another 2 years. So it seemed to me that the 6 years would be long enough for a president to achieve whatever it was he was elected to achieve. But he would never be under the pressure of distorting his own judgment because he had to satisfy this group or another group in a future election.
And while we're on the subject of term limits, you've also proposed term limiting senators and representatives in Congress. Can you talk a little bit about that proposal?
Yeah, over my 6 years, I saw witnessed too many times when a colleague acknowledged that although he believed that A was the right way to vote, because an election was coming up and he had to satisfy this minority or that minority, he would have to vote Y. And that is a service in Congress had become a career, and you started protecting the career rather than doing what you thought was in the best interest of the country.
Now let's talk about another way that you've had influence on public policy that, despite the wonderful introduction we heard from Nate, was not discussed. And that is the Buckley v. Valeo case, the issue of campaign finance in general. And I want to focus you specifically on what I would call a very innovative proposal that you have for providing by law the campaign contributions could be unlimited in amount, but strictly anonymous. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I happened to be in the Senate when the 1974 Campaign Reform Act was enacted, and that was the one in which Congress placed limits on what could be spent in any election, also a limit on what an individual could give to a member, a particular member of Congress. The Supreme Court, in its wisdom, knocked out the limits on spending as not permitted under the First Amendment. But it did say that because of the potential for corruption or the appearance of corruption, it was okay to place that statutory limit on individual contributions to an individual candidate. The result of that is the creation of PACs, these third-party groups often that had specific objectives in supporting a particular candidate. It also ignored the fact that most individuals giving to a candidate believed in that candidate and accepted that candidate's judgment as to how a particular issue should be handled. And we've seen huge distortions in the whole political process since then, reams of regulations and you name it. I'm a simplistic person, and so I would solve the current situation by lifting any limit from an individual to an individual candidate, which would mean that you didn't have these third-party groups with special interests of getting into the act, but to deal with that potential for corruption, the simple proposal is to make it illegal to identify any donor to any candidate. Yeah, the candidate would establish a trust fund or a bank or whatever. The money would go to that bank, and then checks would then go to the candidate.
Thank you. And then while we're on the issue of finance and incentives, let's talk a little bit about saving Congress from itself. And in that book, I think the figure that you quote from most recent data was $750 billion a year going in grants and aid from the federal government to the states. And a couple of the remarkable things about that book is you object to all $750 billion of those dollars, and then you call for revisiting what's been a longstanding precedent of the United States Supreme Court, the Steward Machine Company decision, which Steward Machine, I think, was decided in 1937, I believe. So can you talk a little bit about grants and aid and your views of them?
Well, once upon a time, Congress respected the 10th Amendment, which states that all activities that are not assigned to the federal government are reserved to the states and so on. But in any event, when this decision came out and then Lyndon Johnson started expanding the activities of the federal government into every conceivable area of human activity, members of Congress saw a new way of appealing to their particular constituents by creating programs to give money back to the states, but with strings attached, to deal with essentially areas that were totally within the confidence of local governments. So they'd go home on weekends and talk about this grant and aid program that they had engineered, or how they secured a particular grant for filling a particular pothole in a city, and get all the local headlines. Well, when I was in the Senate, people were just beginning to catch on to this one, and a total of $24 billion were approved for grant and aid programs. March forward to 2014, when I published this book, and you had a total of about $700 billion federal dollars, representing 1/6 of total federal expenditures, being returned to the states, mostly for activities that the states were totally competent to handle, thereby fuzzing who was responsible for everything that went wrong with the programs, and doubling the administrative costs. So my simplistic proposal for saving Congress was simply to abandon those programs. Unfortunately, Congress has yet to notice the wisdom of what I proposed.
But you could see how it would develop, that the individual legislator would now have this ability to promise these things back home. And that's a lot more maybe enjoyable work or politically, you know, advantageous than staying in D.C. and working on a budget, for instance, you know?
Yeah, it meant, incidentally, right now, these programs... And getting the grants occupy a major portion of time that ought to be devoted to all those nitty-gritty problems that only the federal government can handle, including getting entitlements under control.
Jim, obviously, when you add all of this up, you know, Chevron, the single-term six-year presidency, term limits in Congress, grants and aid, campaign finance, and as you know, there's a couple of other things that you floated from time to time. It's a big reform agenda. It's a very big reform agenda. You know that. Why do you think that this particular moment in history requires such a big agenda for reform?
Because Congress is inoperative now. There's no such thing as real debate. And I forget the current situation where each party feels obliged to oppose what another party wants to do. There's no interchange between and across the aisle as there used to be when I was there. You have to simplify and reduce what it is that Congress legitimately focuses on, and hope that by making service in Congress a short-term privilege, that you get the best of the very decent people who continue to be voted in.
So one thing I wanted to follow up on, if you don't mind, is with regard to the term limits. You know, it seems to me, and I think you would agree, that the founders, you know, made a great assessment of human nature, believed in Republican virtue, statesmanship, those sorts of concepts. So your suggestion of term limits to me, is it that you made the assessment that at this point, the individuals who are electing to office just have no ability to demonstrate those Republican virtues any longer? And if so, you know, term limits may be a good idea on one end, but what can we do to change that that trend line, you know, with young people as they're being educated? Or do you have thoughts or ideas on how we can improve, I guess, the level of legislator that's coming to D.C.?
I'm not talking about the level of the educator, but the nature of the job has changed. It's become a career. And human nature is going to protect the career and put that ahead of what is in the best interest for the country on this particular issue at this particular time. It's just, but the Constitution was all structured with a knowledge of human nature and all the dangers that come from it.
Right.
And let's face it, in the earlier days, Congress was in session maybe 5-6 months a year, and people went to return to their normal lives afterwards. It was considered a privilege, and so on. I went through, back in the days, of course, when states appointed senators instead of having them elected by the people, mm-hmm. I went by and I found that very few senators ever served more than two terms in the first three quarters of our country.
And that's really an assessment that the institution has changed so much. Well, that's very interesting. Rob, do you have any other points of discussion?
Thank you very much. This has been enlightening. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with
you today. Thanks for this opportunity to speak.
Well, we appreciate it very much. Are there any other thoughts or reflections on Congress you'd like to offer us at this point?
Well, just that the most dangerous thing that has happened is what we've experienced in the last 2 or 3 years, when, as a matter, when you put parties, this supremacy, party interests, ahead of the national interest by simply refusing to talk to the other people. Can't get anything done that way.
Well, agreed. And these are the sorts of topics and issues the Article I Initiative is focused on. But on behalf of the Federalist Society's Article I Initiative, I want to thank you both for joining us, and I hope to have the pleasure of your company again soon.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.